timber man. What with being a wiki?
Just looking to earn a living, just like any man. Starting new.
On the run. Keeping secrets, are you?
No, sir.
Watch you spill your beans. Rock. 5 weeks? 2 days? Help me to recollect.
Today we're going to cover the film, The Lighthouse. If you haven't seen it, I highly advise you go watch it and come back. You probably won't. You're too excited. And that's okay. And I told you about this a little while ago. I pre-warned you I would be doing a film analysis on The Lighthouse. I advised you to watch it. Because I, in fact, will be spoiling the plot. Because if you watched it, you'll know it's a little strange. It's a little avant-garde. But it'll make more sense when we unpack the hidden symbolism in here. What symbolism did we find? Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Dualism. Carl Jung's reconciliation of opposites. Male archetypes. Male energy. I call this movie the Brokeback Mountain of the Sea. Brokeback Sea. H.P. Lovecraft is in there. Luciferian symbolism. Of course, Luciferian symbolism. Occult symbolism all the time. All the way. This film goes so deep. Promethean symbolism. Yes, it's all in here. We're going to talk about it today. What's this story about? And like I said, plot spoilers are coming. You've been warned. Let's get into it. Oh, and by the way, before we get into it, I do want to also remind you that I do need you to watch The Witch. Right? Or is it just Witch? I don't know. The same director, Robert Eggers. You know what I'm saying. We're going to do a film review, a film analysis on that as well, because believe it or not, it is connected. Sounds crazy. I know it. But I'm telling you, that's the way it is. But the Witch is for later. Viva Itch. Witch with two V's. Go watch that one too. I mean, these are all horror. Well, Lighthouse isn't really a horror movie. Kind of is. Witch is more, they're occult horror a little bit. But The Lighthouse, let's focus here. Focus. What's this story about? What is it about? Well, it's about two guys. And they're tending a lighthouse. And that's what the movie's about. And then, but the scene descends into pure madness. A guy named Ephraim, played by Robert Pattinson, you know, old glittery Edward from Twilight. He plays Ephraim, and then there's a man named Thomas. He's the crusty old lighthouse vet, played by William Defoe. And they both do a great job in this movie, by the way. The Ephraim, I'm gonna give you the analysis of the film after we go through what happens, okay? So Ephraim and Thomas, they're going to get dropped off on the island. They get dropped off. They're both doing their thing. They're both working. They're both not talking. They're all full of toxic masculinity. And they're both sort of tending to their chores. Thomas focuses more on being inside the lighthouse. Ephraim is the newbie. He's the greenhorn. He's working the, you know, the bad jobs. And he is, I believe, he is draining a, what do you call it? Like fecal matter and such. And there's this seagull that keeps messing with him. And Thomas warns him about messing with the seagulls. He says, don't mess with them. He says, they got the soul of the dead sailors. Ephraim don't care. He's mad. So he takes the seagull and beats the hell out of it. He kills it. He slaughters it. Even after Thomas warned him not to. Okay? That happens. Then, you know, they're having dinners and such. And, like, it's just normal. They're getting to know each other. Blah, blah, blah. Ephraim starts hallucinating. He's seeing mermaids. He's seeing a guy that he had previously killed at his last job when he was a logger, presumably. Presumably, that's what we're looking at. And it all gets brought on because they're becoming a little stir-crazy, right? They're trapped out here on this. They were supposed to get relieved 4 weeks later, and the boat doesn't come. So they're getting a little nutty. The relief never comes, and they run out of booze. They start drinking turpentine. Ephraim begs. He begs Thomas. He wants to go work up in that lighthouse so bad. He wants to see the light. But then Thomas forces Ephraim's hand, and Ephraim kills him because he's got to see the light. Ephraim ascends up the spiral staircase, makes the blissful contact with the light before it turns into agony. Then he falls back down the stairs to the earth, and then in the denouement, the final scene, we witness Ephraim being eaten alive by the seagulls. A fitting end. Now, what does all this mean? That's what we're going to get into today. First, the first thing we need to consider, male energies, penises, dongs, schlongs. Well, okay, so we're talking about male energy. We're talking about the male component of duality. And the witch film, I argue, is the female essence of the duality. All right? And why is the lighthouse the male element? Well, obviously you've got two men as the main characters, no women, just the fellas. They're walking, like you can see it at the beginning when they drop them off on this island. Ephraim and Thomas walk past the two previous lighthouse attendants, and not a single word is spoken. Pure toxic masculinity at its finest, I'd argue. It's all about getting the mission accomplished, you know? No one's got time for this sissy getting to know you stuff. How's your day going? We don't like that. That's not what men do. Men get the job done, and that's it. And throughout the film, we see all these base desires. They're farting. They're jacking off. They're shitting in buckets like R. Kelly. Like R. Kelly did to... I shouldn't laugh. But you know what? R. Kelly's... Most of those women were consenting adults. Some of them were underage. I don't condone any of it, period. But like I said before, if the adults are doing it, then they're consenting, then hey... You want to shit in a bucket, knock yourself out. Just don't do it at the Home Depot. Have the decency to take it home. But yeah, these guys and they're raping the mermaids. I mean, it's all in here, right? It portrays toxic masculinity at its finest. But yeah, it's all about the male basic elements here. And why would the reconciliation of opposites happen in this film? Why do we see a male half of duality juxtaposed against the witch, which came out previously as the female essence? You got to look at the Baphomet. This is, of course, the goat with the breasts, worshipped by the Knights Templar and all that. But this whole film, it's about these two coming together and then breaking apart. Ephraim and Thomas. They're very distant and cold with each other at the beginning of the film. And slowly over time, their relationship builds. They get close. They get really close. and then they break apart. They are effectively, if you look at the goat with the boobs on his or her forearms, you'll see the tattoos of Solve and Coagula. He's tatted up, you know what I'm saying? And even the names are a curious element here, because we find out that Ephraim isn't really Ephraim after all. Ephraim is actually Thomas. That's his name also. There's two Thomases here. But you know when that happens? Only after they start coming back together. They're separate entities. The Solve, dissolving, breaking apart, right? And then they're coagulating, bringing together, joining together. They're dancing, having a good time, and then turns out they're both named Thomas. Okay? And we see elements of the duality stuff in, like, on the black and white checkered floor. You'll see that. And I've got images on the Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt, link in the show notes. I posted some images a couple weeks ago from the lighthouse. You gotta see them to believe them. And on that, you'll see the black and white checkered floor. Now, the argument here is that there is, in fact, a Gnostic reconciliation of opposites, which plays into these gender-bending ideas perpetuated by rockers like David Bowie. Rest in peace, of course. Carl Jung was part of this whole thing. You got to look at Carl Jung. He always shows up in all this stuff. His grandfather was a Freemason. His mom was doing seances, talking to spirits. His grandma was doing the same stuff. From a long line of occultists. And Jung himself, he had a spirit called Philemon that he would commune with. He claimed that he was his guru. Maybe he's teaching him yoga. I don't know what he's guruing about, but he said he was communing with this spirit. And Jung was pushing all these different ideas with Gnostic beliefs that would eventually bleed into the Myers-Briggs type indicator test. This is the one that says there's 16 personality types. Which one are you? Right? Turns out that's absolutely not true. And look, I went to college and they made us take that MBTI test. I thought it was legit. Turns out it's not. If you look at the history of it. Everything is contextual, turns out. Depends on the situation as to how you act. Because Jung said we're either introverts or extroverts, which is not true. You can be both. Situation and context determines how you respond. He was setting up this idea of opposites, right? Of this duality that we could then reconcile and become more whole or more better or whatever. He was trying to set up this idea that there was extreme polarities with this MBTI test. And you could see there is a show called Adam Ruins Everything. Sure, he's a social justice warrior beta cuck. I'll give you that. But he has some, it's entertaining. I enjoy it. I enjoy the show. He went on Joe Rogan, actually, and I wasn't impressed. But what do I know? I'm not getting invited on Joe Rogan. So he's still cooler than me. Jung thought that there were only 8 personality types, not 16. Okay? Originally, Jung said there was 8. And that was just a guess about what made sense to him. Just random, right? Then 2 people called Myers and Briggs, they were 2 ladies, and they used to write mystery novels. No scientific background whatsoever. They randomly used Jung's 8 personalities and said, let's just double it, let's call it 16. And that's where your Myers and Briggs type indicator test comes from. It's all garbage. Dr. Jeffrey Santinover, a famed psychoanalyst and former president of the Carl Jung Foundation, said, quote, one of the most powerful modern forms of Gnosticism is without question Jungian psychology, both within or without the church. The ultimate aim of all Gnostic systems is a mystical vision of the union of good and evil. So there you have it. I mean, that's clearly what the goal is, right? Exploring and understanding the polarities, the opposites of good and evil, and then unifying them. A mystical vision of the union. And this union is a product of monism and universal consciousness. This idea that we're all one, there's no differences between us. God is actually good and evil. He's both. He is light and dark. It's all the same thing. There's no such thing as bad, just humans creating a social construct of what is good and evil. Thus, Jung and the Gnostics, they believe there's no thing as a male or female. We're all the same. This is part of the alchemical process, uniting the opposites to create the perfect itself. Now, don't get it twisted here, folks. This isn't a narrative about gender identities. I'm not getting involved with that. I'm just telling you what Carl Jung was saying. Okay? I'm here to talk to you about the lighthouse. I'm here to talk to you about penises. So let's see why Jung would apply this story and all of its penisry. It turns out that Jung, he talked about a phallus god that appeared to him in a dream. Yeah. Sounds crazy, huh? And he called him the man-eater. Let me read to you from Carl Jung here. It was a magnificent throne, a real king's throne in a fairy tale. Something was standing on it, which I thought at first was a tree trunk 12 to 15 feet high and about 1.5 to 2 feet thick. It was a huge thing, reaching almost to the ceiling, but it was of a curious composition. It was made of skin and naked flesh, and on top there was something like a rounded head with no face and no hair. On the very top of the head was a single eye gazing motionlessly upward. Are you picturing this? It was fairly light in the room, although there were no windows and no apparent source of light. Above the head, however, was an aura of brightness. The thing did not move, yet I had the feeling that it might at any moment crawl off the throne like a worm and creep toward me. I was paralyzed with terror. At that moment, I heard from outside and above my mother's voice. She called out, "Yes, just look at him. That is the man-eater." That intensified my terror still more, and I awoke sweating and scared to death. See, Jung thought Jesus was a god of death, and the phallus man-eater was the same thing. The man-eater was the same as Jesus, the god of death. It's all crazy. Whenever anyone spoke too emphatically about Lord Jesus, he called him the man-eater and was symbolized by the phallus. Carl Jung was into some wild stuff, right? So there you have it. That's a lot of the penisry. Reconciliation of opposites. Carl Jung, the man-eater. Not the Hall & Oates song. But you can see on the lighthouse, it's very male-dominated. And the witch is going to be your opposing principles, your feminine principles, that we'll get into on a future show very soon. Now, to continue more onto this theme of the broke back of the sea, the lighthouse itself, that's a phallic symbol, right? Tall, erect, and it is the meaning of the guiding light, right? That's the symbol of the lighthouse. It's the guiding light. You've seen this before in Annihilation. Have you listened to my Annihilation analysis? I'd argue it's one of my best ones. It was one of my favorite movies of all time. I would advise you to watch the movie, then listen to my analysis. I don't want to give anything away, but you'll know what I'm saying when you do that. Spiral staircases are in the lighthouse. This reminds me of Charles Manson. There was a place in LA that had the spiral staircase at the house. He took his family there when they were doing all these satanic rituals and stuff and having these crazy evil parties. But at the time, Manson's family was just a bunch of hippies banging and doing drugs. But Manson himself said at the spiral staircase is where they met evil. That's where evil took over the family. Now, we talked about the toxic masculinity. They're all the whole time suppressing all their homosexual desires with each other. You'll notice that they get drunk and they're dancing and getting real intimate, real close. They're jacking off, they're humping the hole in the mattress. Lots of sexual elements here. Now, there is one scene we need to talk about. The infamous what scene?
What?
What?
That's the trouble with you.
That's the trouble with ye.
With you!
With ye!
No! No! I want a steak! I want a goddamn steak! If I had a steak, oh boy. Oh, a rare, a bloody steak. If I had a steak, I would fuck it.
You don't like me cooking?
Oh, don't be such an old bitch!
You're drunk! You don't know what you're talking!
How can I possibly like the horse shit you fix us for supper?
You're drunk! You won't be saying that!
Tin kitchen shanty cooks. Oh, it was fried donuts three
you're
times
drunk.
A day.
You're
Crunchy
drunk!
Hand bigger
you're
than your
drunk!
Food.
I'm drunk!
You heard me! To be drunk.
Damn ye!
Drunk since I first laid eyes on you.
You're fond of me lobster, ain't you?
Drunken in a Virginia fence.
I seen it. You're fond of me lobster. Say it. Say it. Say it.
I don't have to say nothing.
Damn ye! Let Neptune strike ye dead, Winslow! Hark! Hark! Triton! Hark! Bellow! Bid our father, the Sea King, rise from the depths full foul in his fury. Black waves teeming with salt foam to smother this young mouth with pungent slime. To choke ye, engorging your organs till ye turn blue and bloated with bilge and brine and can scream no more. Only when he, crowned in cockle shells, with slithering tentacle tail and steaming beard, take up his fell befinned arm. His coral tine trident screeches banshee-like in the tempest and plunges right through your gullet, bursting ye, a bulging bladder no more, but a blasted bloody film now, a nothing for the harpies and the souls of dead sailors to pick and claw and feed upon, only to be lapped up and swallowed by the infinite waters of the dread emperor himself. Forgotten to any man, to any time, forgotten to any god or devil, forgotten even to the sea, for any stuff or part of Winslow, even any scantling of your soul, is Winslow no more, but is now itself the sea.
They're arguing over food. Ephraim says he just wants a steak, a bloody steak, and if he had one, he'd F it. Right? He'd F it. So good. And we could argue this is duality of fish and meat, maybe, right? He's tired of eating the fish. He's tired of the lobster. He wants the meat. But we're not going to. But then Thomas, he needs his approval on the lobster, right? A human need there. He needs the approval of Ephraim on the lobster. He doesn't get it, so he curses Ephraim with all the things that are going to happen by the god of Neptune and all the pagan gods, of course. Now, Ephraim, who again, later his name is Tom. So Ephraim and Thomas. And note, by the way, the same name is found in The Witch. Thomasin is the name of the girl. They're all connected, folks, I'm telling you. Anyways, so Ephraim and Thomas, they get into this strange, weird master-slave relationship because it flips around. And old Glittery Edward there puts Thomas on a leash, and he's walking him around, and he shoves him in a hole. Very dominant. And then kills him. Very dark. And speaking of dark, the next topic, nihilism. There's a bit of nihilistic H.P. Lovecraftian stuff going on in this movie. It's this idea that they perpetuate that, you know, bodies are just these pieces of meat that we have to tend to. The doldrums, the boredom that they speak of, that's the enemy. So drinking oneself to annihilation is the solution. Drinking the turpentine. Getting put in a harness and marched around the lighthouse, getting thrown in a hole. That's the solution. Very dark. You'll notice there's no families to be found, right? No pictures, really. The emotional connections are only found after these guys are drinking on the turpentine. And that leads to the chaos, and it leads to death, ultimately, of both people. And you also notice that Defoe, Thomas Defoe, there, he turns into a shapeshifter with tentacles, or maybe even a siren in one of the dream sequences. Very Lovecraftian, of course, something the director, Robert Eggers, admitted to, if you listen to some of his interviews. But there's a sexual connection here. There's a sexy time connection between H.P. Lovecraft's summoning of the great old ones. That's, of course, the demonic aliens. Cthulhu waiting patiently for the humans to bring him, summon him forth, along with his alien demon friends. Because in H.P. Lovecraft, there are orgy rituals occurring in the swamps in New Orleans. And the sexual energies of the two men are summoning these creatures. I would argue, in the lighthouse, that is. Thomas usually naked and spread eagle in the lighthouse, because you'll see that. You'll see times when they look up at the lighthouse, and there's Thomas, William Defoe Thomas, full-on nude. You can't tell what's going on. So he's getting blasted with light, which we're going to get to here. Now, why does all this matter? Well, Theodore Roos, head of the Ordo Templi Orientis, the magical order, he asserts that the biggest secret of Western occultism is that something is at the core of all magical operations. What do you think that is? I'm going to tell you what it is. It's sex. Sexy time. The magical operations can be used to make contact with these supernatural forces. And it also opens this bridge between the worlds. It connects the magician to the dark side of the Tree of Life, which is kind of what the H.P. Lovecraft stories are about. And sometimes, by pursuing and pushing antinomian or unconventional sex acts, those are the best way to do this. That's why sex is at the core, right? Getting yourself into an altered state. That's like in the lighthouse with the dog leash thing. Unconventional, right? Now, the upper degrees of the OTO and the initiations they conduct, 9th, 10th, and 11th degree, they're all about pushing the boundaries of sex. It's about, you know, masturbating on sigils and having homosexual acts when you're not homosexual. It's all about antinomianism and pushing denying the social constructs. Does something to liberate the mind, or so they believe, right? Magically, for a magical purpose. Now, Lovecraft, he also saw these monster aliens in his dreams. Kind of like Ephraim does in the movie. Because Ephraim's seen these mermaids, the sirens, the monsters. He's banging them sometimes. And if you look at Peter Levine's book, The Dark Lord, I'm going to read to you from it. Quote, "The dream is all we may know, normally, of the fourth dimension, while we are embodied three-dimensionally." He says we are viewing the scene from an inner dimension known as the Mauve Zone. And I'm going to do a whole show on H.P. Lovecraft. I've got it in the works. Stay subscribed, stay woke, friends. It's coming. You'll also notice that things get pretty crazy after these fools start drinking. After it's Modelo time, they start drinking on the turpentine. And this is a method known as deranging the senses. It's also witnessed in the Dionysian rituals. But deranging the senses is used to alter the person's perception of reality. Again, an altered state of reality. And a person's bodily functions must be challenged to enter into this new state. That's what yoga is all about. Did you know that? Before it was, you know, horny housewives doing yoga, that's what it was for. It was for the left-hand path tantric occultists. They would use yoga to make contact with these entities. Because the mind and the body, they are connected. Kenneth Grant, the Crowley acolyte, called this retroversion. It's a method identified with Set. Set, of course, the archetype for the challenger of the status quo. Are you still with me? Did I lose you at yoga? Yoga used to make contact with entities. And of course, yoga isn't all for that. There's a non-spiritual element there. You don't have to make contact with entities to do yoga. I'm just telling you, that's the tool they used back in the day. And they arguably still do. Now, speaking of yoga, Luciferian occultism. That's what this movie's about. Let's talk about it. The all-seeing eye. We see it. You see it in every movie. You're going to see it in this one. Again, if you look at my Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt, link in the show notes. You can check out the images I posted a couple weeks ago. So you'll see the all-seeing eye from Thomas, William Defoe's Thomas. You'll see it from the seagull, the one that Ephraim bodies on the the shitter. Then you'll also see Ephraim at the end of the movie with the all-seeing eye. And of course, the all-seeing eye, what does that represent? It represents the third eye being opened, awakening the pineal gland. Again, this is all representative of the Mauve Zone. It's that inner dimension. It's about tapping into the powers of the mind. And in terms of Luciferianism, it's about awakening the third eye, awakening one's truth of reality to this new occult vision of the world. That's why you see it so many times. It's the secret coded language. You'll also see Ephraim. At one point in the movie, he sneaks up to the lighthouse and Defoe shoots him in the eyes with these laser beams out of his eyes, which sounds crazy. You have to see, it's actually very artistically done. But it is a scene that's a recreation from a painting, I found out. An artist named Jean Deville. Who is Jean Deville? Well, it's a dead guy. He's a dead guy. He's a painter. Lived from 1867 to 1953. Oh, and by the way, he was a theosophist, so he followed Helena Blavatsky and all of her cult leanings. Ideas of ascended masters walking amongst us, telling us the truth of the occult languages. But his paintings, they were intended to portray higher spiritual purposes derived from Hermetic and esoteric traditions. So there you have it. And then it's right here in the movie, right here in the lighthouse. Coincidence? I think not. His influences obviously included H.P. Blavatsky, as well as Eliphas Levi. Why is Eliphas Levi important here? Well, go back to the first discussion, the first argument about this movie. It's about the Baphomet. And that is, in fact, the guy who first drew it, Eliphas Levi. Now, his painting, you'll never guess the painting's name. Prometheus. Yep, Prometheus. of course, the archetype of Lucifer. That's what it's all about. That's what this whole movie is about. Luciferian enlightenment. Now, Thomas, he talks about how the light drove the prior guide, the prior attendant mad. But that's also the salvation.
With it, lad.
What made your last keeper leave?
Abe, be second.
Mm-hmm.
Died. Went mad, he did. Raving about sirens, merfolk, bad omens, and the like. In the end, weren't no more sense left in him than an hen's tooth. He believed that there was some enchantment in the light. He notioned that St. Elmo had cast his very fire into it. Salvation, said he.
Now, during one of the hallucination scenes, we see the rotating lighthouse. And what does that mean? Well, it's a sort of film trickery showing us the as above, so below as it rotates. It means it's the entrance to a new world. The movie is about to take the viewer on a journey, a magical journey, from this world to the next. Same thing we saw in Hereditary. And speaking of Hereditary, Ari Aster. That's the director of Hereditary and Midsommar. I did shows on both of those. Check them out. Actually, I think Hereditary's analysis is a Patreon-only show. You can find it on the index. Go to patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher and you'll see it. But Ari Aster, believe it or not, shows up in the special thanks on at the end of The Lighthouse. Curiously enough. Now later, after after they're both going completely nuts, they're both going mad, Ephraim's banging the mermaids, and then he beats Thomas and leashes him up like the dog. They're doing a little puppy play, and he has the rope of the hanged man wrapped around Thomas's neck, and as he's burying Thomas, he's telling him what the light is all about, ranting about the Promethean gods and such. It's actually a very uncomfortable scene to watch. And then Thomas gets out. Ephraim bodies him with the axe. Of course, you got some Kubrick inspiration from The Shining. But we do need to take a listen to what Thomas is saying as Ephraim is burying him.
You wish to see what's in the lantern? Put in my last assistant.
Shut up, old dog. Polish your breastwork.
Oh, what protean forms swim up from men's minds and melt in hot Promethean plunder. Scorching eyes with divine shames and horror. And casting them down to Davy Jones. The others still blind, yet in it see all the divine graces and the fiddler's being sent where no man is suffered to want or toil but is ancient, beautiful, and unchanging. As the she who girdles round the globe. And it's true. You'll be punished.
So Ephraim kills Thomas. He gets the keys. And he goes up that spiral staircase to the light. He touches it, and he's in ecstasy, which turns to agony. And then he falls down the spiral staircase. And the next scene, which we have no idea how much later it is, but it's later. is a nakedy frame on the rocks being eaten alive by seagulls. They even have his entrails coming out. And he's got the missing all-seeing eye. You see, he got the all-seeing eye awakened by the light up at the top of the lighthouse. The scene's very interesting to watch. But you'll see Ephraim here is the Prometheus character, taking the light from the top, up top from the gods, stumbling down to Earth to share with man, and his punishment is being chained to a rock and eaten alive by seagulls, entrails out and all. It's exactly how the Prometheus story goes. Again, it's a Luciferian archetype. So that's your whole film. That's what it's all about. In conclusion, let's wrap it up. Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft, he was very concerned with sexy magic. He was very scared of sex. He was so worried that it was going to open up the gates and let the aliens through. He was sure it was going to destroy civilization. He was actually opposed to the use of magic and all of its knowledge, all of its hidden esoteric knowledge, as opposed to Crowley and others who wanted everybody to practice this stuff. Which is concerning, right? Because all of Crowley's fantasies are coming true. This Aeon of Horus. Everyone's into magic now. Everyone's into witchcraft. The hidden occult is not so hidden anymore. And even scarier, they're prepping us for the aliens. So this is what H.P. Lovecraft was scared about. Everyone doing magic. Everyone opening up the portals to let the aliens in. Now, like I said, we're going to talk about The Witch from 2015. But there's duality concepts with the Lighthouse and its companion film of The Witch. Because The Witch is set in the 1600s. It's an isolated homestead, the woods. The Enlightenment is happening out in those woods. Whereas The Lighthouse is set in the 1800s. It's an isolated lighthouse island surrounded by the sea. Again, juxtaposed dualities of water with land. With the witch in the lighthouse. You got the forest and you got the sea. The lighthouse also has the path to enlightenment, just like the witch does, as you will see. In both stories, they've got these characters achieving this form of gnosis, albeit with different results. Shiva is the male element of kinetic energy. Shakti is the female equivalent. That's the potential energy. And if you've taken physics, you understand the difference between kinetic and potential energy, right? It can change forms. But it's two different things. Now, the Shakti, that is the goddess Kundalini. The Kundalini that is desiring to be awakened to meet Shiva in the marital chamber of the body. It's the alchemical wedding that results in traversing the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, achieving union with Kether. That's God. Such that all of humanity can be redeemed. Why are we talking about this? Because that's what the reconciliation of opposites is all about, folks. Which is what's in this movie. Which is what ties us into The Witch. The Kundalini is the serpent. The lighthouse, the phallus. The Shakti is the female. It's the witch. And they're achieving it with these two films. The amphibious Cthulhu is awakened through the Mauve Zone gate, opened by the sexual energies, altering of the senses. But you'll see it all ends in death. It ends in death, nihilistic death. Just like Jack Parsons experienced. H.P. Lovecraft himself died young as well. All of this is dangerous when it's cracked open. That's the big warning, right? And I'll talk more about the analysis of The Witch when we get to that, which will be out soon. That's all I'll commit to is soon. I mean, we never know who's going to happen, right? Celebrities dying, Illuminate confirming going on everywhere. But the best way to stay in touch, the best way to stay in tune is to subscribe to the podcast, follow me on the social medias, links in the show notes, sign up for my free email newsletter at IlluminatiWatcher.com. That's the way you and I stay connected so you don't miss a thing. So do all that, please. And until next time, stay woke.